Welcome, everyone. Well, it's an honour and a privilege for me to introduce Sarah Waters today. Sarah, as I'm sure all of you know, has published so far four novels: Tipping the Velvet, 1998, Affinity, 1999, Fingersmith, 2002, and most recently, The Night Watch, 2006. She has accumulated awards and prizes far too numerous for me to mention. We'll be here all night, but they include the Betty Trask Award and the New York Times Notable Book of the Year Award for Tipping the Velvet, the Stonewall Book Award for Affinity, and shortlistings for both the Man Booker Prize and the Orange Prize for both Fingersmith and The Night Watch. Now, Sarah has a sore throat, and so it's very heroic of her to be here at all. So she's not actually going to read tonight, but she and I are going to talk, first of all, about various aspects of her work, and leading up to The Night Watch, which has just come out in paperback. And then I'm going to hand over to the floor and give all of you a chance to ask the questions that I know you're going to be burning to ask. Okay, I've heard Sarah Waters described as the true inheritor of the mantle of the late lamented Angela Carter. And indeed, I think you can see in Sarah Waters' work that particular combination of intellectual force and provocative ribaldry, of ingenious plotting and richly textured prose, of scholarly knowledge and of sheer compulsive readability. But interestingly enough for our purposes perhaps tonight, Sarah Waters started out as an academic rather than a novelist. She has a BA from the University of Kent, an MA from the University of Lancaster, and it was after completing her PhD on the idea of history in lesbian and gay literature and other writings that she wrote Tipping the Velvet, the first of three novels set in Victorian England. The first and perhaps the most robust of what have been described as her lesbo-Victorian romps. I mean, I don't know if you invented that phrase.
I did, and I'd rather rue the day now. But I mean, I think it applies to Tipping the Velvet. It's definitely a romp,
exactly,
if any of the novels are, but it has rather come back to haunt me, that phrase.
Well, we might come back to that later. Anyway, Tipping the Velvet takes us into the late Victorian lesbian underworld, into the world of oyster girls, music hall, male impersonation, gay prostitution, aristocratic women's clubs full of predatory sapphists, and so on. So how did it come about, Sarah? I mean, how did the PhD, did the PhD lead into the novel, or was the novel a reaction against the PhD?
No, the novel, Tipping the Velvet, grew totally, actually, out of my PhD. Because what I'd looked at in the thesis was, as you say, the representation of the gay past, really, in writings about homosexuality and by gay people from the late 19th century onwards. And that gave me a couple of things, really. It gave me a sense of the sexual underworlds of late Victorian London, late Victorian culture, British culture. And at the end of the thesis, I'd looked at contemporary lesbian and gay historical fiction, of which there's a sort of small but significant genre in Britain and America. And what I found was that the gay men's fiction, even the gay men's fiction written by women, because there's a woman writer called Chris Hunt who writes fantastically great gay men's historical novels, it tends to be quite ambitious and quite very confident about male sexuality, very sure of a gay male presence in history. Whereas the lesbian historical fiction, on the other hand, tended, to my eyes, to be rather sort of smaller scale, rather a bit less ambitious. It liked to see its lesbians sort of isolated, you know, rather rural, sort of falling in love with each other, not really knowing what their feelings were, and then sort of setting up house together in the woods, you know, becoming sort of wise women, things like that, which was, I thought, was all very well. But I began to think it would be nice, and above all, it would be fun to try and write a novel that told a different sort of lesbian history, you know, one that was a bit more colourful, a bit more urban, and a bit more about how there might have been a range of ways to experience lesbian desire in the 1890s, not just one way. So while I was finishing the PhD off, I really came up with the idea for Tipping the Velvet, and just thought it would be a bit of a lark, really, to try and write it. And when I finished the PhD, it was actually in those days, which was sort of the mid-90s. I don't know what the situation is now, but then if you finished a period of study, you could go on the dole. You could claim unemployment benefit, which I did from Hackney Council, which I'm very grateful for, and gave myself a year to try and write a novel, and then and wrote Tipping the Velvet in that time. And then not at all expecting to really go on writing fiction, certainly never expecting Tipping the Velvet or any of my novels to get the sort of attention they subsequently got. But by the time I'd finished it, I was actually quite hooked then on writing fiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll go on to the next stage in a moment. But, I mean, thinking about being hooked on that, and many people will have encountered your work, probably, or some people anyway here may have encountered it first with the televised version of Tipping the Velvet, which was scripted by Andrew Davis and created a certain amount of controversy and stir. And I wonder, I mean, how far were you involved in the adaptation, and what do you think about it now in retrospect, a few years on?
Well, I watched it. I came across it on UK Gold or something quite recently, and I watched the second half of it, and I was actually quite, you know, taken with it all over again, really. And certainly the experience of seeing it adapted from start to finish was a very positive one for me. It was lots of fun. And I mean, I went from the point of thinking, you know, first being approached by the production company saying they'd got Andrew Davis interested, and, you know, Andrew Davis, I thought, this is never going to happen, you know. The BBC are never going to adapt it in its form in all its sort of raunchiness, really. But they, you know, the production company and Andrew were convinced by it. Andrew said he would only do it if the BBC agreed to keep all the sex in it, which is very typical of Andrew. And then, you know, then he wrote the screenplay, and I didn't have any sort of real creative input. I didn't really want any anyway, but I was happy to just be included in the process. Mm-hmm. And then, lo and behold, the BBC gave it the go-ahead, and so then you know, I met the actors and the director and went on set and had a part as an extra, in fact, in that. Yeah, which was great fun. And was just, I mean, you know, I never felt too precious about the book. I think, in retrospect, of course, I think I've been lucky with both my adaptations that they were pretty faithful to the books, and it can be, I think, a potentially quite traumatic experience for an author. But I always took the view that, you know, it was never going to change my book. My book would always stay the same, and if the adaptation was good, that would hopefully reflect well on the book, and if it was bad, it was sort of somebody else's problem, really. And as it turned out, you know, I think they did a pretty good job, and certainly the attention it got in newspapers and things like that, much of which I'd say Andrew Davis himself did a lot to, you know, to stir up, was very positive. It seemed very positive to me at the time, and quite an event. You know, it felt like quite a TV event to get this thoroughly lesbian program getting the BBC period treatment. I was very excited by it.
Kind of landmark, really. Yeah. Okay, well, people may want to ask about Tipping the Velvet later, but I'm going to move on to Affinity now, which stays in the later 19th century, but it's a much more somber novel in some ways, which focuses especially on spiritualism and the women's prison and the philanthropic visitor to the women's prison. And I think you could say that spiritualism and philanthropy, dabbling in the lives of the dead and dabbling in the lives of the women's, of the living, so to speak, were two of the kind of major occupations of Victorian middle-class women in the period. But, I mean, I wondered what particularly attracted you to these themes, particularly to the question of spiritualism, but also to the sort of enclosed institution of the women's prison.
Well, having written Tipping, which is a very upbeat account of lesbian life, and I mean really a fantasy history, you know, of the kind of history I wish that lesbians had, you know, I wish we had on record, lesbian pubs and lesbian clubs and things like that, would be great. Mm. Having written that account of lesbian life where, you know, my heroine precisely has a sort of range of lesbian options to choose from and has to do the decent thing and choose the right one, I wanted in the next book to do something that was a bit more realistic, I suppose, in the sense of dealing with, or at least giving a very different side of Victorian life and dealing with lesbian desire, you know, in isolation, lesbian desire without perhaps without a community, without a vocabulary. And at the same time, I wanted to do something that was a bit more gothic. I've always been a big fan of the gothic ever since I was a child. And of course, one of the attractions for me of Victorian culture is its great gothic institutions, you know, asylums and prisons and workhouses and things that I'd grown up with in Hammer horror films, really, you know, as a kid, and as I say, always been kind of attracted by. And I've also been interested in spiritualism, actually, since I was a child. And as a student, used to go to spiritualist meetings in it purely in a really kind of voyeuristic way, but in a fascinated sort of way. And there's been quite a lot of feminist research done on spiritualism in the 19th century and the particular opportunities it offered to women and working class women. You know, it was an institution in which women could become quite powerful in a funny sort of way. And I say in a funny sort of way because I think lots of people felt that women were very good mediums because femininity was passive. You know, it was a sort of conduit for the spirits. And actually, in women's prisons, there were similar sorts of ideas about femininity, but, you know, being a special thing, that it made women prisoners, you had to handle them in the right kind of way, and they were sort of extra emotional. And so I had the two things, you know, spiritualism and women's prisons in my head. And sort of brought them together in what I felt might be a slightly arbitrary way at first, but in fact, the more I looked at them, the more I found crossovers, and then actually found evidence of spirit mediums who'd ended up in prison, you know, charged not unreasonably with fraud after they'd, you know, said, oh, to somebody, oh, your mother's coming through, she's telling you to give me that diamond necklace, you know, that you've got. And so that was amazing to me, to find that there really had been spirit mediums sent to prison. And so that novel sort of coalesced around all those ideas, really.
And after I read Affinity, I went back to Alex Owen's book, The Darkened Room, which I think must have been one of your sources for Affinity, which is a historical account of Victorian spiritualism. And it's a wonderful book. It's full of suggestive detail. I mean, and after reading Affinity and then going back to Owen's book, you can't but be aware of all the possibilities which are offered by kind of intimate contact in darkened rooms, you know, by but Owen never actually suggests that the relationships can be seen as lesbian. She doesn't really acknowledge even a kind of sexual component in these relationships. And I think this is to do with a particular kind of picture which was being offered by historians at the time, that there were no lesbians before 1880 or 1900 or 1920, whatever, you know, date you stop at. And I wondered whether in writing Affinity and your other Victorian romps, did you feel that you were being kind of liberated from such arguments, or is there a kind of implicit critique of such arguments?
Well, I sort of, having done my PhD in the 90s, I still feel quite attached to that argument, you know, quite important argument in sort of lesbian and gay history, that actually our modern sense of sexuality, heterosexuality, homosexuality, didn't really emerge until that late 19th century. And that makes a lot of sense to me, and I think it's one of the things that makes the 19th century and earlier so interesting, is because the further you go back, the stranger the sexual landscape becomes and the harder it is to fit it to our modern models. But at the same time, you know, people do pop up in history to sort of confound that. You know, you've got John Addington Symonds, for example, who was homosexual in the late second half of the 19th century, writing in his memoirs quite early on about how he felt, you know, distinctly different. He felt like a different sort of person. He wasn't doing what other boys were expected to do, and he was sort of troubled by it and looking for other people like him. And then, you know, 50 years before that, you've got Anne Lister, based at Halifax, gentry woman, keeping diaries in code all about her sexual affairs with other women. And again, talking about herself, you know, as somebody different, as a distinct, somebody with a distinct identity, you know, which sounds very modern, you know, to somebody like me. So I think in the books, I suppose, I've always wanted precisely to find points of contact with the past around lesbian sexuality, to be able to write about characters who I feel are sort of just like me in the way that, but in other ways aren't at all, or at least the landscape, the cultural landscape on which they're moving isn't. So, for example, in Fingersmith, you know, with my two young, Sue and Maud, my two young heroines who fall in love. And in a sense, the class distance between them is more of a problem for them than the fact that they've fallen in love. Mm. So I suppose one of the things I've wanted to do in the novel is to sort of come at lesbian desire from a slightly different angle and or sort of focus on this, actually. You know, here's the lesbian desire, but actually it's this that's the issue in the book. Mm. So the lesbian desire is both at the heart of the book and yet somehow incidental to it as well.
Mm. Interesting. Just a couple more questions about Affinity. Mm. I mean, Affinity has a fantastic plot twist, which I don't want to give away for anyone who hasn't actually read that novel. I mean, in a way, this is the Sarah Waters trademark, is these kind of amazing kind of reversions or twists of plot. And I think the experience of reading the novel as a reader, I feel that you, I mean, however skeptical you are, you can't help but long for spiritualism to work, you know, for spirits to kind of manifest themselves and pass through walls while you're actually reading the novel. And I wondered how difficult it was, you know, in the writing of the novel to create this kind of spell for the reader, so to speak, to sustain that kind of suspense. I mean, did you have to work at it? Where did you learn it from?
Well, I think it must be partly just with the pool of narrative, you know, that what we do when we read a novel is to surrender ourselves to something we know is untrue. You know, we're surrendering ourselves to a fiction, to a lie. We want to do that. There's something, seems to be something inherently human in wanting to give yourself over to a narrative like that. So I suppose that with affinity, and lots of people have said exactly that even though they know it rationally, it can't be going to happen. They really want this, you know. And certainly I suppose I wrote it in a spirit of cynicism, really, about spiritualism, but at the same time thinking about all the other sorts of pulls that spiritualism must have had, you know, the real emotional pull of spiritualism, and just writing, occupying a position of some sort of belief, you know. And if you do that in the narrative, it's amazing how far your reader will travel with you, actually.
But I mean, there is an immense skill in managing to take the reader with you in that way. But man, and just one more question about affinity. I mean, you have said that your characters have no life beyond the novel, and unlike Jane Austen, who was always prepared to expand on exactly what had happened to, you know, Elizabeth Bennet or whatever. And in most cases, I think in your novels, this makes sense. The story is kind of complete. You know, you get there, and the story is done. But in the case of affinity, I confess that I do rather want to know what happens to Selina and Ruth, and perhaps even to Margaret after the end of the novel. I mean, are you not prepared even to speculate on this?
Actually, no. I was aware while I was writing it that Selina's story, after the end of the pages of the book, was in a sense more interesting than the story I was telling. It would make a fascinating story. But of course, we only get Selina's story in fragments, really, and then through Margaret's diary, which is the main body of the book. And I have to say, no, I haven't. But it does, I always think of I tend to think of the novels in different ways. I used to think of them as like little pieces of architecture, that you could sort of, like a little model cathedral that the reader could wander through. And, you know, I would spend a long time making it. Or I've thought of them as engines. Or recently I've begun to think of them as being like ghost trains, you know, I'll sort of build a thing, my reader has to strap themselves into this little car and then be propelled around, and then, you know, sort of spook jumps out and things like that happen, and I'm in control. I'm being a novelist is being a megalomaniac, really. You know, I'm in control of the experience. But it is, you know, it is like a little world everything has to work in at the right moment in the right place, and doesn't really, and it sounds terribly hard and sort of calculating, and of course it is calculating, but it doesn't mean I don't engage terrifically with my characters emotionally too in the world of that book, you know. But I know they.
But then it's done.
Then it's done.
Yeah. Okay, to move on to Fingersmith, which is the third of the novels set in the Victorian period, and I must say, with one of the most audacious, complicated, and fiendish plots I've ever encountered. I'm talking about plot twists. But Fingersmith is more Dickensian, really, isn't it, in focusing on the Victorian criminal underworld, with a sort of nod towards, or more than a nod towards, Victorian pornography. And its subject matter, I suppose, closer to that of sensation fiction of Wilkie Collins and Emmy Braddon and so on. It's full of mysteries, doublings, abductions, dark secrets, double crossings, and sinister plots. So would you say that you had a macabre imagination? And if so, where does it come from?
I think it developed when I was a kid, watching all those Hammer films. I was obsessed with horror as a child, and in that way that children are, where you can't, because you have no empathy as a child, you know, you have no empathy, really, I think, until you're a teenager, and so you can watch these dreadfully macabre things and just think it's kind of cool, you know, you can't make the connection. So as a kid I used to write, and all I wrote were you know, terribly derivative gothic stories with dire twists at the end. So in a sense, Fingersmith was exactly the novel I was destined to grow up to write, I think, in lots of ways. Fingersmith was great fun to write, and all the things you've mentioned, I was aware of. You know, Dickens, I've always been a big Dickens fan, so I sort of wanted to take on the Thieves' Kitchen. The novel opens in a sort of Fagin's Thieves' Kitchen. And the novel of sensation, a bit like spiritualism, I was aware of what it offered women, I suppose. Women writers have always been big on sensation, big on melodrama. Mary Elizabeth Braddon was one of the big sensation novelists. She wrote Lady Audley's Secret, Aurora Floyd, which were quite best-selling and quite risque novels at the time. And, you know, they often featured women who were going mad, or who had committed bigamy, or committed murder, or thought they'd committed murder. You know, women on the verge of a nervous breakdown, really. And they seemed wonderfully sort of transgressive figures, especially given that I think our stereotypes of Victorian heroines tend to be of rather wishy-washy, Dora Copperfield-type characters. But you only have to turn to Wilkie Collins with his wonderful, strong female characters, or to Mary Elizabeth Braddon, to see very different women characters. And for me, you know, all I had to do was sort of combine that with some of the lesbian scenarios from pornography, to sort of topple it over into full-scale lesbian romance, really. It was easy and great fun to do that. To make it, I suppose what I thought I was doing was taking on the novel of sensation and making it tell stories that it couldn't, as sensational as it was, you know, it couldn't quite tell in its own day. It couldn't really talk about pornography, it couldn't talk about lesbianism. But if you go to the more underground literature of the time, if you go to pornography or to sexual memoir, or to police records or diaries, you get all that extra information, you know, and then build up a slightly different kind of picture. Mm. I think it is all there in sensation fiction and in Dickens to a certain
extent. You're just eliciting the latent content, as Angela Carter
that's a nice
would
way
say.
That's very
nice. Anyway, Fingersmith is enormous fun. You know, it's more in the kind of romp category, I suppose. But I mean, most of the plot twists in Fingersmith arise from double crossings, from betrayals of various kinds. And I've noticed that betrayal does seem to be a recurrent theme in your novels. And I wondered whether you wanted to comment on that.
Well, I know it is, and people often ask me what the attraction of betrayal is, and I can't really account for why personally I'm drawn to it, except to say that I think it obviously has a real pull for me. You know, I think it's just such a horrible, the idea that, Jeanette Winston actually in Orange is Not the Only Fruit, I think she talks about, or maybe The Passion, she says, you know, betrayal, and by somebody betraying you, I mean somebody pretending to be on your side when all the time they're on somebody else's side, which I think puts it very well. And the idea, it seems worse to me than simple unpleasantness. You know, it's somebody who's actually, as Jeanette Winston says, pretending that they've got your interests at heart, when in fact they're sort of working for the other team. And so I think it's it's one of the worst things in the world, which is why I'm drawn to it. I can't account for it more than that.
Okay, well,
there
you
must be some incident in my childhood. Mustn't
Anyway, to move on to Night Watch, I mean, which is the latest novel, and I mean represents various kinds of new departures for you, I think. The most obvious being that it's set in the 1940s, during the Second World War. And I wondered, I mean, what drew you to this period, and whether you had any qualms about dealing with a time that's still within living memory? Because, and the Victorian period is safely history, but there are quite a lot of people around who can still remember the Blitz, so...
Yeah, no, I was very conscious of that. And what took me there in the first place? Well, I think very slender things, really. I having written those three novels with a Victorian setting, I wasn't in any sense tired of the Victorians, but I felt that it might be a good time to make a move. You know, I didn't want to become known as somebody who could only write Victorian fiction. And actually, I wanted to see if I, you know, maybe I was somebody who could only write Victorian fiction. I wanted to try something new out. I thought it would be good for my writing to make a move. But I've never wanted to go pre-Victorian, especially. I think you run into problems with language there. You have to, people start saying gadzooks and things like that, and it all becomes a bit weird. And you have to work harder, I think, to find a language that sounds both archaic and modern, and that's never particularly appealing, I don't know. And I've never yet wanted to come into the present either. So I knew I was looking for a 20th century setting. And I'd begun to think about London just after the war, because I realized that though I felt I knew quite a lot about the war, or at least I'd seen the war represented quite a lot, I hadn't really seen much representation of life immediately after the war in London, which when I thought about it, I realized must have been quite strange and particular, you know, living in a city, like lots of cities, of course, Birmingham, Coventry, lots of cities in Britain and Europe, living in a city that had the guts bombed out of it, living with rationing worse than ever, you know, return of the servicemen, return of women to peacetime life, and all sorts of things like that. But also, as much as that, you know, one of my ways into the period, I think, was old movies, British movies. Brief Encounter has always been a big favourite film of mine, and the glamour of that, the peculiar glamour, the peculiar British clipped glamour of that sort of film, and the, you know, I mean, Brief Encounter is an utterly heterosexual romance, scripted by Noel Coward, though, and it has, to me, it has this rather queer sort of subtext to it. You know, it's all about falling in love with the wrong person, falling in love when you shouldn't fall in love, and, you know, choosing to do the decent thing and to return to domestic life and leave that forbidden love alone. And I began to think, well, what would happen if I took this particular 40s landscape and put lesbians in it? You know, what would it look like then? And what would their stories be? And from that, you know, that produced the novel, really. I started off with my three main women characters, Kay, who was a rather sort of lonely, restless figure, and then Helen and Julia, who were trapped in a relationship that was a bit sort of past its best. And they were women who were closer to my age, you know, because with the Victorian novels, for purposes of plot, really, I'd ended up with quite young women, women who were discovering their sexuality, starting their journey into the world. But I thought with this book, it would be interesting to write about women who'd sort of done all that. You know, they were comfortable with their sexuality. They had a community, lesbian community, and they'd been through relationships and were sort of coming out the other end. And so they were the heart of the novel. And then the two other main characters, Duncan and Viv, sort of came in and broadened the whole thing out a bit. Mm.
But the mood of the novel also, I mean, seems more muted and more attentive to kind of realist detail than some of your earlier novels. And you've said that your novels are often first triggered by a colour or a mood, and that the mood of the Night Watch is grey. Mm. The characters in the novel aren't, you know, they aren't flamboyant, they're not performers, they're not criminals, or, you know, they, but people leading comparatively ordinary lives. I mean, was this an attraction? Was this a deliberate shift of focus for you?
It was a bit, although I think what I hadn't anticipated when I started to plan the book was how much the period itself, or at least the period that I found with what I took to the period, would sort of shape the novel. So, as I was saying before, really, with the 19th century, you know, the Victorian culture has always seemed to me to offer itself up in its gothicness, you know, in its extravagance, in its colourfulness, so that the characters that I tended to write about did tend to be what you might think of as sort of outsiders or slightly marginal people, you know, theatrical people, or prisoners, or spiritualists, slightly alternative sort of lives. But with the 40s, I suppose, oddly enough, you know, our stereotypes of the period, I think, are of combat, or of men at war, heterosexual women on the home front, you know, dealing with that very, very courageously. And I suppose, again, I wanted to look for slightly fresher stories that I hadn't come across before. So my characters are, in a sense, peripheral, in that they're gay, or they're conscientious objectors, or whatever. But as you say, on the whole, they're just pretty ordinary, really. They're just people like me, just kind of getting on with things, and sometimes entering into the war in quite courageous ways, but probably most of the time just sort of keeping their head down and trying to get on with things and, you know, deal with it, really. Mm. Mm.
Another distinctive feature of The Night Watch is the structure, of course, that it's the story is told backwards, like a detective story in reverse. You know, you get what's happening now, and then you find out what lies behind that. So the novel starts in 1947, after the war is over, and then it moves backwards to end at the beginning in 1941. And I wondered, just at what point in the writing did you decide to structure the novel in that way, and why did it seem appropriate for what you wanted to do in this novel?
That wasn't my very first intention. As I say, I went originally to the post-war period, the 1947 setting that the novel opens on. And but what I found was that my characters were exhausted. That's sort of what I liked about them. They were tired. They'd been through this traumatic experience, just as London had, just as Europe, the world had. And I didn't really know what to do with them. You know, I didn't know how to move them forward. I realized that they were all sort of stuck. They were all in thrall to what they'd been through. And I understood that that actually was what I was more interested in. And I've always been drawn to the idea of telling a story backwards. You know, there are some great plays. Pinter's play Betrayal is a wonderful example of how you do that. You know, you meet a relationship that's ended and you follow it back and all its ramifications. It's a terribly poignant way of talking about relationships in particular. And there are other sort of plays and books I could think of. And I, even with Affinity, actually, I'd thought of setting part of that backwards. It's crazy, really, sort of setting Selena's diary backwards, but it got too complicated. Yeah. But it has always been in my mind as something to try. And I suddenly thought, well, hang on a minute, maybe with my characters here, it would work. And suddenly, you know, the three-part novel fell into place for me. And it made a lot of sense because I realised, in all sorts of ways, because I realised that it fitted this whole thing about my characters being sort of stuck in on their pasts. And it was also like a sort of archaeological excavation, just as the city had been sort of blown open. So I was sort of exposing my characters' lives. And it felt like real life to me. You know, how you meet when you make a new friend, you meet the current version of them, but the process of getting to know them is all about picking up bits about their past and following them back, and then things begin to fall into place. So it felt very natural. Mm. And actually didn't feel that different to structuring a novel in any other sort of way, in that, you know, a novel is all about releasing information, certain bits of information at the right sort of time. So it was still a question of what bit of information do you give when, you know. What did change was, of course, the whole thrust of the novel became not what has happened, no, not what will happen, rather, confusing myself now, because, no, that's not right either, is it? What is it? Not what's happened, but why it's happened and how it happened, because we know what's happened. We know, for example, that none of the characters are going to die, because we know they're alive at the start. So, even with that, it still felt manageable, the structure. And I like a technical challenge anyway. Right. I like that sort of thing. I did worry that because the first part of the book is pretty static. It's when my characters are most tired, and I did worry that my reader might just get fed up with that, really, and not stay with me to the second part of the book, which is really where the drama and more of the excitement lies, you know, with the wartime scenes.
Mm, the wartime scene. We're taking up this idea, I think, of archaeological excavation and so on. And The Guardian have been, I don't know if anyone else saw this, but The Guardian have been running a fascinating series on writers' rooms. And recently your study was featured as one of those. And I mean, it's a fascinating series. And often the rooms, I mean, it takes a number of kind of well-known writers. And what you find is often the rooms are full of clutter, you know, photographs, sort of exquisite but strange little objects brought back from Peru or Tasmania or whatever, or toys. but your study, as pictured in The Guardian, is very sparse. It's minimalist, even with only the writer's essentials, so to speak. Apart from the maps on the walls, you know, which you can display there, and you said that you'd used the map of London to plot the characters' movements in the Night Watch. And I was reminded of something that Elizabeth Bowen said in her preface to The Demon Lover, which is a collection of stories set in the Second World War. And Bowen says, "I see war, or should I say feel war, more as a territory than a page of history. Of its impersonal, active historical side, I find not written." And I wondered whether that struck any kind of chord with you, and how important place and geography and so on were in your work.
Well, I think, you know, so far I've written all the novels about set in London, and obviously I live in London, and I've lived in London for a long time now, and I love London. I love London, I think, with all the passion of a convert. You know, I came to London from a small town in Wales, which had been a great place to grow up, but London offered me all sorts of extra things, you know, sort of community and different ways to live, and there's sort of place in London for everybody, I think, really. So. And I'm very interested in London's history, and I love the way that, as in all towns and cities, really, London's history is very visible on its streets. You can walk down the street and see different eras side by side. So with the Victorian novels, every time I walked down a London street, all I could see was the 19th century, really. I could see 19th century houses. And with this novel, The Night Watch, suddenly London just looked very 1940s to me. I could see where buildings had been blown up and replaced, or where shelters had been, or... And I was reading about people's experiences of the city. So it's very natural to me to set my novels on a very real, what feels to me like a very real landscape. And certainly for the purposes of the Night Watch, you know, I had four main characters, and for all sorts of reasons, I wanted them not to live near to each other. So I physically had to plot them on the map, really. And then, of course, what happens is, whenever you make decisions in advance about your characters like that, with Fingersmith, you know, I pretty much plotted the whole book out in advance of writing it. But what happens when you start to write it is that you realise that the decisions you've made about your characters say something about them. So the very fact that my characters were in London at all, in wartime, when lots of people were sent out of London or voluntarily moved out of London, said something about them. I had to find reasons for them to be there. And the bits of London they'd chosen to live in, I realised, you know, like as with everybody, sort of said something about them. So it becomes really interesting. There's this real link, I think, between geography and emotion and character and motivation that's fascinating for me. But yes, certainly the wartime thing, I just became fascinated with how Britain had changed during war and what physically my characters would encounter as they walked down the street. And again, what that said about the mentality of the time. I mean, if you read things like Mrs. Miniver, you know, the Jan Struther series of essays, novel, whatever, from the 40s, she writes a lot about the new things people were encountering and how that slightly changed people's moods. And, you know, it's fascinating stuff.
And just one more last question about The Night Watch. I mean, we were talking earlier about Elizabeth Bowen's The Demon Lover, the stories that I mentioned earlier. And those, I mean, they're set in the Second World War, but they're very surrealistic and spooky. They give you a very kind of ghostly London landscape. And I mean, I was saying that I thought that you might, your imagination, your kind of imagination might have been tempted by that, you know, kind of approach to the Second World War, rather than the more sort of muted and more realist. Were you tempted?
Well, actually, I think when I moved to the 1940s, I think I was going to write a sort of 40s Gothic, because that's, as you say, that's what I was used to doing. And I think I thought I could sort of import all that Victorian, that lovely Victorian melodrama into the 40s. And I was aware that there are some great examples of 40s Gothic, you know, from the time. I mean, films like Gaslight, or not Arsenic and Old Lace, that's American, and Pink. What's it called? The sealing wax. Pink String and Sealing Wax. Is that right? With Googie Withers, where she murders her husband. You know, there were great... In the 40s, people were looking back quite a lot to the Victorian period, actually, and I think, did a lot to set it up as a rather Gothic kind of era. And then you've got writers like Patrick Hamilton, who actually did the screenplay for Gaslight, I think, as well as the screenplay for Rope, the Hitchcock film. So a great Gothic writer, but wrote a sort of drab, a lovely drab British, more sort of John Betjeman kind of slightly depressed British people landscape in novels like The Slaves of Solitude, things like that. So there was a real, you know, there was that sort of darkness, or some of Graham Greene novels, you know, The Ministry of Fear, or even The End of the Affair, wonderfully moody novels, even if they're not exactly Gothic. And that's certainly something I wanted to take on, but... it didn't turn out like that in The Night Watch. You know, I became much more interested. It became a much more character-led book. And I suppose I became more interested in the ordinary texture of wartime life and the paraphernalia of wartime and how people interacted with it in very ordinary ways, but that nevertheless had a big depth of emotion behind them. So it's more in the book I'm writing now, actually.
Yes, that's going to be my final question before I open things up to the floor. It is rumoured that your next novel is going to be set in 1940s Warwickshire, very close to home. So would you like to, and I know you're in fairly early stages, but would you like to say a bit about that, to tantalise us?
I'm quite, worried about talking about it here. And again, I realise I didn't pick up on your question about writing about the 40s being within living memory, because, of course, I was very conscious of that when I wrote the book. It hadn't been an issue with the Victorian novels. I knew nobody would ever come along, you know, from the 1860s and to say, you've got it wrong, we didn't do it like that. But with the 40s, of course, there was a very real possibility that people would. So I was conscious of that. And yes, the Warwickshire thing, you know, I'm not... I have no connection with Warwickshire, I have to say, but for all sorts of reasons, the book has ended up being set here. And I guess it may change as things develop, but... I'm reading about Warwickshire and reading about Warwickshire in the 40s, and It's a novel with a rural setting, which is a big departure for me, being such a London writer. And even though I grew up in the country, in South Wales, I grew up in the country in the most non-rural way imaginable, I think, like lots of people in this, in a very small town. You know, the country was something we drove through to get to another town to do our shopping. So I'm having to learn very basic things about the country and about Warwickshire. So I've got lovely Ordnance Survey maps from the 1940s of Warwickshire, which I'm poring over as a wonderful distraction from writing.
More maps.
Yeah, exactly, more maps. So, but I have been up to the area and just sort of travelled around and had a look to get a feel for the area. So if anybody can recommend any books, by the way, that would be helpful to me, that would be great. But I'm sort of slowly picking my way through the literature.
Thank you very much. Okay, now I'm going to open things up to the floor, and I have been asked to repeat your questions into the microphone. This is not being rude, apparently it's something to do with the strange acoustics of this particular room, but who would like to ask the first question?
I do apologise, by the way, for not doing a reading, but I've just had this throat problem and I don't risk it, but so please do ask a question. I'm very happy to answer questions.
I've got lots more questions. Yes, Emma.
Hi. I was just wondering if you were interested in writing fiction about sort of lesbian couples in a sort of very everyday sense. And it sounds like maybe that's sort of what you're moving towards. But I was just wondering if you could ever sort of see writing a novel like an Austen novel, where the characters actually didn't really have any trauma, or they were necessarily betrayed, they didn't have any sort of anxiety.
You mean a Jane Austen novel? God, I should be so lucky as to be able to write a Jane Austen novel. But that would be great, actually. I do tend to go for the rather lurid, and I do tend to go to betrayal. And so actually, you know, even though I'm writing about lesbian couples, in quite ordinary lesbian couples in the Night Watch, they do tend to do awful things to each other, and, you know, they're pretty upset a lot of the time. So I can't quite see myself doing that. I should say really too that the novel I'm writing now it doesn't have any lesbian characters in it at all, which is another departure for me, because I'm so identified with my lesbian writing, and I've always, you know, banged on about how important it is to me to be sort of reclaiming lesbian history, or at least sort of, you know, reimagining or imagining lesbian history. But the novel I'm writing now doesn't, it's not like it's a heterosexual romance or anything like that. It's not that kind of story. But I am thinking ahead to the next novel, which I think probably will be a return to a lesbian story, which, if it won't be ordinary exactly, will be hopefully more sort of upbeat than this novel. I'm drawn to melodrama. I can't help it, really. I think there's something very female about melodrama. I watch lots of 40s films for research. For this book and the one I'm writing now, and you know, it's amazing how often, you know, the women's movie sort of melodrama comes up, really, especially maybe in American films, but also British ones. And I'm just very, very drawn to those extremes of feeling, because I think that actually, even though, I mean, lots of people do live genuinely melodramatic lives, you only have to look at the newspapers for that, but I think even people who live very ordinary lives like me, you know, I think at times you can be, your experience of emotion can be melodramatic, you know, so that you might not literally have had a mother who's been hanged as a murderess, for example, but, you know, your feelings about your mother sometimes might resemble the gothic extremes of novels, or your feelings towards your girlfriend might resemble gothic extremes. So I suppose for me the melodramatic and the gothic has always been a psychological thing. Well, it's true that we don't often see it, but then, of course, if you think about, do we often see, I mean, most stories tend to be about conflict, don't they? They tend to be, certainly if you look at soap operas, everybody's miserable, aren't they? Everybody's having a hard time. So yes, I take your point. We don't see, we think we see, I think, a lot of representations of happy heterosexual relationships. And we certainly don't see representations of happy lesbian and gay relationships a lot. But, you know, I'd hate to think that that's what I had to do. You know, that was my duty to the lesbian community and the larger world, was to write, produce those sorts of positive images, you know. I mean, you know, I live a happy lesbian life myself, and it's the last thing I want to write about, really, which I know doesn't help the kind of thing you're talking about. I appreciate that. But I'd like to think there's a difference between, well, I what I'm doing, which is writing about the complexities of lesbian relationships, sort of from within a lesbian perspective. You know, I hope there's a difference between doing that and, you know, producing like a lesbian slasher movie or something, you know, or a movie where the lesbian gets stabbed to death at the end. I like to think there's a qualitative difference there. But, yeah, I know what you mean, yeah. Jane Austen, lesbian slasher. That would be a good one. Yeah.
Yes.
This is from the Victorian novels, and so it seems that in the Sarah Waters universe, the resourceful housemate always wins. And I was wondering, because in the three Victorian novels, they're all somewhere the figure of the maid is revenged in there, and I was wondering whether you could tell me a bit more about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay, this is a question about the figure of the maid in Sarah Waters' fiction and the way in which, in her Victorian universe, the redoubtable maid always seems to win.
Yeah, well, you can't go back to Victorian fiction now without thinking about those servants and what they were up to, you know, off screen, as it were, off place. I mean, Dickens was interested in the sort of energy and the what he thought was, I suppose, is the grotesquerie of working class life, but certainly at the end of his novels, things tend to be nice and neat, and everybody knows where they are. But of course, for somebody like me, it's far more interesting to focus on the characters who aren't centre stage, either in Victorian fiction or in, until quite recently, our representations of Victorian life. So, and I mean, I think that's very much of our time, isn't it? You know, it's how, when people go to apparently National Trust properties now, all everybody wants to see are the kitchens and the maids' rooms and things like that. Partly, I think, out of a sense of our own family histories. I mean, probably most of us, like me, certainly my grandparents were in service. It's something that it's a way of connecting with the past. But also, I think it is very much that we're a bit tired of hearing a certain kind of story, the drawing room story, rather than the below stairs story. So it just seemed natural to me to focus not just on women's stories, but also I think partly because I tend to write about all female romances, it felt natural to me to write about the differences between women, rather than to suggest that, you know, all women are the same and, you know, that they're not, and class and economics make very real differences, you know, between women. So yeah, that's just naturally where my interests have gone, really. And I think it's amazing how, even though we do live in a climate where we're used to paying attention to other sorts of stories, it's amazing, for example, how many people can read Affinity and get caught out. I mean, not to give anything away, but Margaret has problems in the novel because she's got a certain kind of class perspective. And of course, because the novel really encourages you to share her perspective. Again, it's the power of narrative, I suppose. You don't tend to kind of look beyond it. But often, I think the most interesting stories are the ones at the edges of things, really.
Is there a Welsh story? Because then you grew up in Pembrokeshire. I mean, will you ever write about that, or is London now the place of your imagination?
Well, London has been until, of course, my move to Warwickshire. Mm. And I do feel Welsh, and in fact, I'm learning Welsh now. It's the most fiendishly difficult language in the whole world, but I'm learning it just out of a sense of wanting to sort of to connect with something from my past. I do visit Wales a lot, but I grew up in a very Anglo part of Wales, Pembrokeshire. And I feel that having lived away from Wales for so long and having only really quite a marginal connection with it, I would feel like a bit of a fraudster claiming a big Welsh identity now. And certainly the language is a problem, I think, if you want to address yourself to proper Welsh history. So no, at the moment I don't have any plans to do a Welsh novel.
Another question?
Do you use much contemporary lesbian pulp fiction?
Do you read much contemporary lesbian pulp fiction, and if so, who do you like?
I suppose it depends what you mean by pulp, really, doesn't it? And actually, I don't tend to read it so much these days, but I read it an awful lot when I was younger and first coming out, and first excited by finding, you know, a lesbian community, a lesbian feminist community. So in my 20s, I read an awful lot. I read everything I could get my hands on and was very, very grateful for it. And, you know, lots of it was relatively pulpy, but, you know, lots of the American stuff was romance, or it was sci-fi. Some of it very good sci-fi, I have to say. Or it was historical fiction, which was interesting to me. Or detective stuff. And it was, I mean, some of that lesbian or feminist detective fiction was really exciting at the time. It was really challenging using the genre, pushing the genre in new directions, and using it to really address, as crime fiction has often does, you know, often done, really address, you know, really interesting topics in modern cultural life, whatever. And science fiction was doing the same, I think. In fact, I think science fiction is, women's science fiction is due for a bit of a renaissance, lesbian science fiction. Maybe Austin's slasher movie in space or something.
Star Trek.
Yeah, lesbian Star Trek. But I have to say, when I started writing lesbian fiction myself, I tended to stop reading it. So I've got lots of friends who are writing British lesbian fiction and some American friends, and so I'm sort of aware of what's happening in lesbian writing. But I do like to read contemporary fiction as a whole, but I read so much for research that I tend to read in a really bitty kind of way for contemporary stuff, so only some of it is lesbian, really.
Another question over there.
So the question is about research and about the relationship between the absorption in the research and the actual writing of the novel, whether the two things are going on simultaneously.
The two things do go on simultaneously in the sense that I continue research, what I call research, right until finishing the book, which is, for me, that's reading fiction. Well, say with The Night Watch, you know, I read a lot of 40s fiction. I watched a lot of 40s films. I read diaries, published diaries mainly from the period. But I usually start off the whole writing process with a period of intense research over several months. Having gone to a period with some sense of the story I'd like to write, and then the research will throw up ideas for character and plot that sort of cluster around that initial idea and push it maybe in a slightly different direction or certainly build it up. And then what happens is I'm usually itching to start writing then after those few months, because of course my characters have come, I'm quite excited about my characters. And at that point I'll put that heavy sort of research behind and be at home mainly. And of course with a novel like The Night Watch, the research at the start felt quite overwhelming because there's so much material about the war. There were so many new resources available to me, things like film or sound recording or artifacts. You know, I could go to the Imperial War Museum, for example, and not just look at the display, but, you know, they've got a great archive. I called up pocket diaries and, you know, call up papers and things like that. I went to local history archives and looked at maps and photographs. So at first, as I say, it felt quite overwhelming. But of course, every time I made a decision about my characters and, say, where they lived or what they did, my research then focused down. So, for example, there's a character called Kay who drives an ambulance during the war. And once I've decided that, I could then look very specifically at ambulance driving during the war and read everything I could about that. There's an ambulance museum, even, in London, which has a Second World War-type ambulance. So I could go and look at that. And, you know, so, and then once I'm writing, sometimes I will stop for a week or two and go back to the British Library or go back somewhere and look again at something I really, really need to know. But I think the thing about research is that you quite quickly get to a point where, of course, you don't know everything you need to know, but you know enough to be able to make educated guesses about the bits you don't know. So I will quite happily write a scene knowing that I will have to come back in the future and change it a bit. Maybe change what my characters are wearing. If they were had a particular uniform, or, you know, things like I can add in details later. So that sounds a bit calculated, but it's the whole thing about how accuracy, I think, is something that every historical novelist has their own rules about, and there are some very basic things I like to keep accurate. With Kay and her ambulance driving, I could find out quite a lot about that, and I liked to keep that as accurate as I could. But other things, like working for a particular branch of the civil service in the 40s, I could never really find out the exact information I needed to know, so I just made it up, really. But, you know, I hope I made it up in a way that sort of right and, you know, kind of served the bigger purpose of the book. Because after all, I'm not writing history. I'm writing something a bit different, a novel that has to have its own kind of imperatives and environment. But research is, you know, absolutely grounds me. It's where I start. In fact, it's one of the things that when people often ask me if I'll ever write a novel with a contemporary setting, and I can't imagine writing a novel that doesn't require a lot of research. For me, it's my way in. It's my way into fiction. You know, it's what gets me going, really. So it's my springboard.
Mm. Over there.
Hi.
Do you ever feel that, as a writer of lesbian fiction, that critics approach this genre in a rather more reverential way and are fearful of being harsh about your work?
I've never really thought of that before. That's a new anxiety now, isn't it, for me to brood over? Thank you for that. I've just naively taken my reviews at face value, but I think there may well be an element of that. There may be an element of that, it's true. But most of the... I suppose I like to think that there's more to the books than just the lesbian, you know, element. That there's the whole, there's the narrative, there's the storytelling, there's the research, you know, there's all that side of things, which I don't think you would need to feel squeamish about criticizing. If you, and indeed, you know, lots of people have been critical of the books, and so it's possible. Yeah, I would like to think not, you know, because certainly, of course, I don't want to be seen as a special case. I just want to be, I'm just a writer, as far as I'm concerned. I'm just a writer, like any other writer, you know, trying to tell a story in a successful way. So that's the ground I want to be judged on, yeah. Do you think that?
Do you feel patronised by your critics?
No, I don't. Sure, yeah. Yeah. I haven't felt that, no. I think because of the way I write, as I was saying before, really, the lesbianism is of course, it's important to the books, but there's... I think as a reader and as a critic, you'd be led to focus on other things, actually, you know. Yeah. Oh, blimey.
No, in answer to your question about Warwickshire, I had realised in sort of post-main asylum in Warwickshire I had the privilege of looking into the archives, but I never realised how you didn't have to do a lot to make it into an institution in between 1860 to 1996. Those lives touched all of the different spaces in Warwickshire, and also what strategic building that institution was in the British Cosmopolis. Because that building, they're always built institutions in the city of towns and railway lines, because that's getting a good through the assignment. But the bombers actually followed the railway lines and canals up, and to have the privilege of working with people who were there in the 40s. You realise the farming, the agriculture, the community, which was all drawn in from around Warwickshire, but it was such a community, such a
speaker is talking about Warwickshire in the 1940s, and she's talking about the archives of the asylum of Warwickshire, and not only about how the archives demonstrate the ease with which people found their way into such institutions, but also the strategic importance which the asylum occupied in the community as a whole. Yeah.
Yes, well, thank you for that. I mean, it makes me realise, actually, hearing you talk about it, that, of course, when I, you know, writing about Victorian asylums, I did take a rather gothic line, although I did do research into, you know, real people's experiences of the mental health system and tried to sort of do justice to that. But I think it is, there is something about time, you know, that the Victorians are far enough back that we can kind of play around with them and have fun and be a bit larger than life with them. It makes me think that to take on something like an asylum life that bit closer would, you know, I'd want to be much less gothic in the way I'm used to. I mean, actually, my new novel isn't that kind of book anyway. But that's very interesting, actually. Yes, thank you. And of course, think about institutions and the war. One of the reasons I have scenes in the Night Watch set in Wormwood Scrubs prison during the war, because I became interested in prison life, you know, with air raids going on, and read accounts of people say it strange ways in Manchester, being in their cells during an air raid, and the warders would sort of disappear into their shelter, leaving prisoners in a cell in a building that might very well be bombed, and just the terrible idea of being trapped physically in a cell, you know, with sort of bombs raining down about you, was just absolutely dreadful, really. And it was, again, it's not an aspect of wartime life that we tend to think about people who were in institutions.
Do we have another question? So this is a question about being organised as a writer, I suppose. Once you've done all the research and you've got your sketches, how do you go about putting it together? Yes.
I am pretty organised and pretty disciplined. I think you have to be as a writer, really, because, you know, if you sat around waiting for inspiration to come, you'd never write anything, frankly. So I treat writing like a job and write every day. And I would answer this question by saying I write 1,000 words a day. That's what I aim to write, is 1,000 words a day, because, of course, at the end of a writing week, then I've written 5,000 words, and at the end of a month, I've 20,000 words, and, you know, it gives me a big chunk to sort of work on. And actually, with the novel I'm writing now, I've been keeping a writing diary, so every day I'll sort of just jot down what I've been doing, just for my own interest. And I'm realising that when I'm writing fresh stuff, I do write 1,000 words a day, but I do much more rewriting as I go along than I thought I did, actually. So what I tend to do is, and actually thinking about it as a sketchbook is very good, because I do sort of picture, I tend to work scene by, you know, I tend to visualise scenes in advance very clearly, and the bits in between are less clear to me. So, you know, for me, a novel is like, I suppose, a series of beads on a string, you know, with the beads being kind of meaty scene and then the bit in between. And I think with a scene, I'll work over it quite a lot, maybe for a month, you know, on a scene, rewriting it, and then either move forward to the next scene or actually leap forward to a scene in the future, if that's more exciting to me than sort of just inching forward. And then, so it's like a puzzle. It becomes a bit like a puzzle, and it was especially true with The Night Watch, which is in itself a book of sort of snapshots, really, and has big gaps in between the sections, things we don't know about the characters. I did a lot of rewriting with that novel, and it was quite unnerving to me to do that, because with my other novels, which are very much more plot-based, I did have the whole thing worked out in advance and could pretty much leapfrog around and then fit it all together. Certainly with Tipping the Velvet, I wrote the middle section first, because I knew most about music hall, and that was a sort of Oscar Wilde sort of 90s thing. And then I came back and did the oyster trade bit, you know, much later, but sort of fitted them together quite seamlessly. But as the books have become more ambitious, it hasn't necessarily, you know, been easy to do that.
I think I could take a couple more questions because we've been working Sarah pretty hard now, and I think we wouldn't want to exhaust her altogether. Okay, one there. Could you repeat the question? The second half of the question.
Yeah.
It was just in terms of coming out and tipping. You said that Tipping the Velvet had been very important to you when you first read it at the age of 15.
Do I see myself as having a responsibility to...
Yeah.
Especially with young lesbians in mind. I don't exactly know. I'm always sort of surprised and quite humbled, actually, when I hear from younger lesbian readers, or from people who tell me they first read my book when they were very young, or sometimes, you know, people write to me, well, like somebody wrote to me recently to say she was at school and she'd had a girlfriend at school and her girlfriend had split up with her and she was really miserable and her English teacher had given her a copy of Tipping the Velvet to read, which I thought was absolutely amazing, you know, and could never have happened, I'm sure, when I was that age, or even, you know, more recently. And it seems wonderful to me, actually, that my novels can have that kind of extra emotional impact on people, but I don't write with that in mind. I'm delighted that it happens, you know. I write, actually, ultimately I think I write for myself, you know. I write the books I'd like to read. I write with a lesbian agenda because I have a lesbian agenda in life. It's just part of my landscape, part of my emotional and cultural landscape, so it seems natural to me to tell those sorts of stories. And they're not, as I was saying before, they're not always really positive stories. I mean, my lesbians do terrible things to each other, actually. but I, you know, it seems to me, you know, living in a lesbian relationship, in a lesbian community, it would seem false to only talk about good lesbians. You know, the world, lesbians are good and bad just like everybody else is good and bad. So I like my characters, I like my lesbians to be villains as well as heroes, I suppose. And I think the fact that most of my strongest emotional experiences have been with women for good and for bad, that inevitably spills over into my novels, and my character, you know, that's true for my characters too. But I hope that writing about lesbians from within a lesbian world is somehow positive, you know. And just the fact about writing about lesbians at all, I think, and that I'm now in this very luxurious position of having quite a large audience, you know, and quite a mainstream audience as well as a gay one. And I think just to be writing in a relaxed kind of way about lesbians, just treating, because it's normal, it's just really ordinary, actually. Sometimes it's banal to be a lesbian, you know. It's not exotic, it's not melodramatic, really, at all. And I think just to be writing about it as an ordinary thing is still quite important, you know.
Okay, do we have one more question?
There's one.
I can see one. Yeah. Have
no.
you thought oh, about sorry. Writing for the stage at any point?
No, I never have, actually. I really like the theatre, and especially when theatre's good, I think it's like nothing else. You know, it's absolutely electric. But I feel no real affinity with the genre, with the form. I wouldn't know where to start. I wouldn't know where to start in writing a screenplay. I love films, and I've been asked more often to write a screenplay. And to me, it seems it's completely different to writing a novel, you know, which is leisurely, especially the sort of novels I write, you know, leisurely. It's all about mood and atmosphere. And when I saw my novels converted into screenplays, it was really quite startling at first to see my lovely long chapters kind of turned into half a page of dialogue. Because of course, all the stuff that I spend time over, like scenery and costume and things like that, you know, in television and film, you have different departments, do you? Yeah, the costume department does, or the scenery department. So it feels like a different world to me, drama and film, and I'm happiest actually just being part of the audience with that kind of thing. Although I do often get, I mean, certainly with film more than theatre, I find it very stimulating to see it, to see a narrative played out in quite a small space of time, to see the shape of a narrative, and sometimes to think about why it doesn't quite work or why it does work. I find very, very instructive as a novelist. I can sort of take things back to writing fiction.
Thank you very much. I think we have to draw things to a close there. I've been asked just to make a few announcements. To say that Sarah will sign copies of her books here in this room now. If you want to rush out, the bookshop is outside selling copies at a discount, so you can rush out, get your copies and bring them back in again, and she will sign them. And I'm asked to publicise the two next events. First of all, the writing program. First of all, Roger McGough next Monday, on Monday the 12th here, and Rage Omar on Sunday the 18th will be also be speaking for the writing program. But now I think we should just thank Sarah fantastically for all the time that she's given.
Thank you.